Welcome to Doctor's Orders with your host, Dr. Baker. Now let's join today's program.
Hello, everybody. Happy, happy Saturday with Doctor's Orders. I am Dr. Baker, the owner of the only business hospital in the world, and we're really excited to bring you today's show. There's so much to discuss in such a small, limited portion of time, so we really want to make sure that we bring you information that's going to be really helpful to you and your business. Our show, it consists of bringing highlighted businesses, subject matter experts, and other business professionals that, number one, play in the space, number two, have the ability to help you no matter where you are in your business. If you want to join today's discussion, you can do so by calling 859-291-2255. Once again, that number is 859-291-2255. If you want to send me a message directly, I will certainly respond within 24 hours, and that is info@drbaker.us. Once again, that's info@drbaker.us. And when I say that I own the only business hospital, what that means is that I invented an industry that helps small businesses, and we categorize small business as 500 employees or less, or $50 million in revenue and under. So as you can tell, that's a lot of businesses, very diverse businesses in various stages. So we're talking micro businesses, boutique businesses, mom and pop shops, startup founders, legacy and family businesses, all the way to businesses that have been really established in their space. All of us have troubles and problems at times, and we need assistance. We need to know what direction to go in. We need to know what our best practice is. We need to figure out how to increase our revenue or do better by our employees. And so the purpose of Doctor's Orders is to assist you with that, no matter where you are in your stage of business or in your stage of thinking about your business. And so today's guest, I'm really excited to bring on because there's just been so much discussion in the last couple of weeks amongst my patients around his expertise. His name is Stephen Janai, and he is a patent counsel, and he's really good, one of the best that I personally know. I do a lot of work with Stephen Janai, and he's been so helpful to me personally, and he's been very helpful to my patients in his with his expertise. And so without further ado, I'd like to bring on Stephen Janai. Stephen, how are you today?
Good, Dr. Baker. Thank you for having me on today.
Absolutely. And so as I talked to you earlier, I said, you know, I've been doing a lot of business assessments and producing ratings for businesses to show them where they are in their health. And one element that has come up, you know, consistently has been intellectual property. And I know over the years, I've worked with businesses, and they really don't know what to make of intellectual property. And for all the listeners out there, when we make a statement such as intellectual property, I think we all believe that we have to invent something. We have to turn into, you know, Inspector Gadget or Bill Nye the Science Guy. We got to do something that someone else hasn't done before we lean on a patent counsel. But that's not really true. If you don't mind, Stephen, kind of walk the audience through just whether it's common occurrences of intellectual property or even complexity surrounding that, just so they can have a clear picture as to why your services are important.
Sure. No, I understand. I would have to say the biggest issue that I see with companies that not asking the questions ahead of time, you know, not trying to seek advice of what they might want to do in their work. My thought was always a dirty little secret of big law firms is that we would do much more work for somebody who didn't ask questions up front, you know, where you could have had somebody who asked a $500, $1,000 question ahead of time ends up being, you know, $200,000 or $2 million to fix later after they've run into trouble, you know, not asking for any advice, thinking that might be too expensive. I see that quite often.
Well, you know, when we talk about, you know, asking for advice or even thinking about asking for assistance in this realm, intellectual property is as simple as even your logo. Is that right?
Well, correct. It doesn't have to be an invention, which would be covered by patents. It would also include trademarks or copyrights or even trade secrets. If you think about a company like Coca-Cola, this is a massive, you know, billion-dollar company here, and what is their value? Their value is in their logo, their trademarks, their trade secrets, not a particular invention. Pretty much anyone could take and create a, you know, carbonated, colored, sugared beverage, right? But they're very successful because they have the mark that tells people, you know what you're getting, you know the source of goods. Because people want to know when they're buying it, what am I getting? And they say, well, I want Coca-Cola's product, not someone else's.
Well, I want to spend some time on just the trade secret first, and that there are restaurants, there are individuals that have a service that they offer, and they use a special process for that service. But in their minds, they never think that that process is a trade secret, or they don't believe that how they go about preparing a dish is a legitimate trade secret. It might be their grandmother's famous recipe, but they don't claim it as a trade secret. Can you speak to, based on your experience, why there's such a disconnect there, or even why there's a reluctance to say, you know what, let me formally do something to protect this?
I think people often go right to, do I have this new invention, right? And with trade secrets, there's a lot of things that can be covered by that. It could be customer list. It could be supplier list. It could be you're doing a very common process. It could be how you make your, you know, pasta carbonara, whatever it is. It could be, you know, a machine composition, complex system in the back of your factory, where the process as a whole might not be new, but after years of working the system, you know the little tweaks that you get your system to do much better, you know, whether it's faster, cheaper, whatever. And so those kinds of things can be protected by trade secret. Trade secret is a state law as opposed to federal. And assuming you take the steps necessary for protecting your secrets, number one being that you keep it a secret, it means that you have a cause of action if someone steals your secret recipe.
You know, what about bad actors out here in the world in which we call them ambulance chasers, where there's some individuals that do not have any intent on using something, but they're fouling things just to keep someone else from doing so and watching to see if someone will make an accidental infringement. How much do you see that type of behavior, whether it's currently or just throughout time with your experience? And is it something that business owners should be worried about when it comes to a product or a service that they want to offer that maybe they haven't done a search for?
It is an issue. Whether or not it's as big an issue as the news media likes to make it out to be, I'm not sure. But yes, with patents, there's no requirement that you ever make, use, or sell your invention. You just have to be able to come up with it first, file a patent application, be able to describe how to make and use it. You could get exclusive rights. What are patent rights? Their patent rights are the ability to prevent others from making, using, and selling. And so there can be quite a lot of value. Sometimes you'll see a company who want to protect, say, a product that they don't want to make, but they don't want you making it because they make a different product, and they don't want this out there, say, competing with them. That's one area you'll see. Another is someone who says, you know, I want to do this work. I'm going to make this invention. They file for patent protection, and knowing that they don't have the resources, say, to exploit it. They don't have the resources to, you know, build a factory and start making a widget or whatever it is. They want to license it out. Now, whether you say those are bad actors or not, depends, I guess, on which side of the equation you're on.
Which makes really good sense. You know, I want to stick on the concept of patents, because I hear a lot of my patients who do not have any formal intellectual property filing. They will say, well, I want to get a patent on this, or I want to get a patent on that. And a lot of times they're using the terminology incorrectly, or they're not certain what they're actually saying. Can we break down a little bit more regarding patents when we talk about, I want to get a patent? I want just to give the audience a sense of, one, what should they be thinking about when they even think of the word patent? And number two, what does that process look like in order to actually obtain a patent?
Well, I would start with the United States has pretty much some of the most liberal rules on patenting an invention. You know, patents are for inventions. Those could be, you know, a machine, a composition of matter, a method of doing something. The Supreme Court one time had a case and they said pretty much anything made by man or anything human created can be patented. You know, there's a few exceptions. It can't be a law of nature, some natural material, that sort of thing. But if you can come up with an invention that meets the criteria, which the details are complex, the overview is very simple. The patent office just asks, is it new? You know, is it something already out there, or is it, you know, novel? And if it's new, is it non-obvious? Is it a trivial, obvious variation of what's out there? Or is it something that would not have been obvious from known inventions?
When you talk about that obvious part, that has always been what I would call a complexity, because there's things that would seem obvious, and you and I have had this discussion in the past, that an examiner might say, well, that was obvious, so therefore we're going to reject. But the counter response is, if it was obvious, how come it hasn't been done this way? And so then you can have a back and forth. How usual is that with your experience?
Well, I'll start with obviousness has been written into the law since the 1950s. And to me, there's never been a good definition. It's a little bit like pornography, where you say, I know it when I see it. And there's a lot of court cases that try to lay out a framework and different factors. And it's always written about as though it's very, you know, mechanical and absolute. But it is very, very gray. There's nothing I can tell you about that. I will tell you from my experience, when we file a patent application, what happens in the process, you file an application, they get all the ducks in the row. Eventually, it gets assigned to an examiner who's in the sort of technology area, qualified to look at it. They do a search, they do a review, they issue an opinion. I will tell you, very close to 100% of the time, we'll get an obviousness rejection. Sometimes when I've gotten one that didn't get an obviousness rejection, I always think, I wonder if I did something wrong. but part of it is because it's so easy. The examiner will look at your, you know, invention. They'll say, you know, your widget has A, B, and C. And if they can't find A, B, C out there, then they look at, well, what is out there? So they'll find a reference that describes A and B. They'll find another reference that has C. And then they'll say, well, if you put these together, you have A, B, C. And it's very easy for the examiner to do that. They like it because that gets it off their desk, I think. But it also puts the ball in your court. And it says, okay, there's all this out there. Now, you know, make a case that it's not obvious, and it puts the ball in your court.
Well, you know, I think that there's a lot of elements of that, and one of the elements is that could cause for discouragement, especially if you're trying to file one on your own. You know, if you were just a person that said, you know what, I'm going to do this myself, I'm going to do a Google search, and I'm going to see how I'm going to, you know, file me a patent, and I get that obvious rejection. Well, at that moment, because I'm not patent counsel, I don't know what I'm looking at. I don't understand the process. And now it leaves me discouraged to say, well, maybe what I have isn't so novel or isn't so great. Or maybe it already exists and I didn't know that it did. When really, in fact, that's not the case. It's just that you don't know what you're looking at. And a lot of times, that's the difference between creating something that has stickiness and that is meaningful, or just taking something and throwing it in the garbage. Do you see that, or have you seen that in your experiences?
Oh, yes. I definitely have people come to me and they have filed something. I always say, you know, you could also do your own brain surgery, but either way, I wouldn't recommend it. What happens is, and I do try, I would say today, to make that point that pretty much getting an obviousness rejection is just part of the process. I learned that early on. I had a client and we filed an application. We got a response back. It had an obviousness rejection in it. And I sent it to her. And she called me in about, I don't know, 2 hours later and fired me and said, I know you must be doing something terribly wrong because they got this rejection. And I tried to explain that, you know, this is just common and we'd have to just make our case as, oh, why is it not obvious? You know, that sort of thing. And she moved the work to somebody that I had trained at a different firm, and even called me up and said, I'm sorry about this. She just thought that there was something wrong. And that happens. So I try to educate people up front what to expect, how the process goes. It's not an easy process. I will tell
if you're just okay. If you're just tuning in, this is Doctor's Orders. I've got Stephen Janai, Patent Counsel. We're talking about intellectual property, so patents, trademarks, trade secrets, and the like. And so we know that this is a big topic amongst anyone, especially in the startup community or someone looking to launch a different product or service. These are concerns that come across many small business owners. And so that's our discussion for today. And I want to go back to the point you were just making there, Stephen, as it relates to just the confusion that exists. And your example with a former client that thought that you didn't do a good job because of her lack of understanding of the process. I would make the argument that that is a contributing factor to many small business owners. I'll give a great example. When I was in the automotive industry, when vehicles would come out with, let's call it a new technology, you know, new bells and whistles, if you will. And one thing that I would tell my sales consultants is that if they don't understand how this technology works, they're going to call it stupid. They're going to think that it's broken. They're not going to like it. So they have to understand what was just created in order for them to appreciate it. I imagine it's the same thing in your world, considering that you are an attorney, but that your work looks significantly different than a criminal attorney, or even obviously family law, or even just that of a business lawyer, because they believe that they've invented something. And how many times have you heard, no one else is doing this? I haven't seen this anywhere. But that's also because their scope is limited. It's only so much they can see. Now they're coming to you to say, take this thing out of my mind that doesn't exist, even if the elements or the components are very complex, make it real, write it up, and then get this done. And oh, by the way, get it done for very little and get it done by next week. Does that ever happen to you?
That is common. And it does go to every person. You just can't know everything. And so getting good advisors is critical, whatever your business is and whatever stage. You need some people who can give you guidance, and especially before trouble. I always point to an example. I wasn't involved, but a company at a factory, they had hired a company to create software that basically ran the factory, all the business processes in this factory. And they, when they hired the company to make or create this software, they just said, oh, looks good, signed it and paid and went on. So then later, the company was very successful. They wanted to move the company. They built a much bigger factory. And at the last minute, found out that contract said that they can't move. The software contract was written that the software could only be used at that factory at that address. And they had just signed it without reading it. And it eventually cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars just to get the right to move to a bigger factory.
Wow. And when you're looking at, and you know, you hate to scare people, but you're also making them aware,
yeah,
is that how things are written, what it's indicated for, all of that is really important. And it's no different when you're filing a claim for intellectual property, is that how it's written becomes really the entire battle. Is that right?
Yes. Words matter, and particularly in intellectual property, words often have very particular meaning that might not be understandable in a normal context. In patent claim language, you may have the word comprising or the word consisting of. And to most people, you're saying, well, you're saying the exact same thing. You're just using different words. And they're completely different. One is extremely broad coverage and one's extremely narrow. It's very important to understand that. But yeah, it's all the time. One of the common things I'll see is someone will send me an agreement to review, and one of the comments they'll say is, I've looked at it and I think it's okay, but I want you to just look over it again, you know. And it often is not okay. It's because there's certain clauses that just don't ring a bell or, you know, set off an alarm. It's always good to have somebody take a look.
You know, that's a very strong point. I make that point regularly as it relates to words and the strength of words, especially in legal matters, because those words are there to produce certain outcomes, and they're also there to create points of differentiation. And as a common person, you're not privy to the etymology or how these words have come to be used in the state of law. And therefore, you can actually put yourself in a trick bag, if you will. You can actually make things significantly worse for yourself when you're trying to navigate the space on your own, which is why I tell individuals, make sure that you have someone that's an expert in the space. Now, for an example, if you know, you wanted to turn in something and say, you know what, I've got some intellectual property of my own, well, it's okay if you decide to move forward in that. But if I'm a person that worked in IT and I decided that I had this new Flipgrid tripper that I want to go ahead and build, but now I want to turn that in and I become my own lawyer, I find that to be a common mistake. When you're out here working, you know, with just different people that's looking at, you know, intellectual property, how do I protect what it is that I have? You know, what are some of the, I would say, common errors that people think about or that they make when they hire you for service and they think they should have something, but really it's not that it's an obvious rejection, it's really they don't have something? How does that really look in your world, and then how are you able to communicate that to people?
That does happen. And I would say, you know, fairly, you know, frequently someone will come to me, they'll say, I have this device, this method, and commonly the phrase is, I've looked, you know, I don't see anything like this out in the world. And what the issue is, they often don't understand, is that it's okay if a product doesn't exist in the physical world. It can still be unpatentable if it's just described somewhere. So it can be described in a patent. It can be described in a printed publication, that sort of thing. It doesn't have to be that you can go on Amazon and find the product. Although I will tell you, more than once, I've had someone come to me with a, you know, an idea for a product, and I do a search on Amazon, and I sometimes will come up with the very product they want to make. I'll send them a link, and I'll say, I see there's someone selling this exact same thing. You know, tell me how yours is different.
Mm-hmm. And what about, you know, I have a name, I registered with the Secretary of State, but someone in Oregon has the same name or they have a logo that's similar. How do people deal with that issue?
Well, I always say trademarks are a little bit different. With a patent, you never actually have to have made the invention. With trademarks, they're their power sort of comes from use. You have to use it in commerce, you know, selling goods. Registering your name with the Secretary of State is nice, but it's sort of computer driven where they're doing a search. They're saying, has somebody registered this exact same name in Ohio? That doesn't tell you a lot. When it comes to trademarks, it's okay that, or not okay, but it often is the case where there isn't already a registered mark, say, for the same word or words. Where it becomes tricky is that the standard at the trademark office is your mark confusingly similar to another? And like obviousness, that's very subjective, right? Is this, you know, confusing, you know, the buying public? And so very often I'll have someone say, you know, well, I want to use Microsoft as my mark, but I'm going to spell it differently, or whatever. The trademark office doesn't consider phonetic spellings or misspellings or whatnot to make it different. They're looking at what is the impression on the buyer? Would they be confused as to what's the source of goods? That's the whole purpose of a trademark, telling you where did these goods come from. And if the buying public might think products of one are coming from the other, that's where it's an issue.
Well, you know, and in that case, is that how you go about constructing your business and how you go about presenting your business to the world really is important, especially if you believe or if there's evidence that you're going to have good market saturation. You want to make sure that your business stands alone and that it's clear and that others aren't confused by what it is that you have. Stephen Tanai, if anyone wants to talk more about intellectual property, patents, trademarks, trade secrets, how can they find you?
I have a website, denilaw.com. It's JENEILAW.com. I'm happy to answer questions for anyone.
Fantastic. And on top of that, if anyone wants to get in contact with him, you can obviously reach the Business Hospital at drbaker.us, and we'll assist you with that. Everyone, it's been a great Saturday. Hopefully you learned something or we sparked something in your mind. I hope your businesses are healthy or gets healthy real soon. We'll see you next week.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Baker.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you for joining us for Doctor's Orders. You can contact Dr. Baker by phone at 1-855-249-4677, by email at info@drbaker.us. You can learn more on our website at www.drbaker.us.
Doctor's Orders, Saturday mornings at 10:30 on WCBG, 1320 AM, 103.9 FM, and www.1320thevoice.com.